Okay, so this is the title, Stabilization of Pumps by Noise. This is work I've been doing with Andre Longton, who's supposed to be arriving, perhaps tomorrow, in the physics department at Ottawa. So just to get started, so we know what's going on, start off with a picture of a neuron. This is what a neuron looks like. Okay, it's basically a type of cell. Three interesting parts here. The dendrites, the soma, and the axons. So basically, electrical impulses come in from other neurons and from the outside into the dendrites. They come down to the soma. There's some sort of nonlinear processing that goes on. The signal is then sent back along axons to the other neurons. So the title includes the word bump. So just to tell you what a bump is, it's basically a spatially localized batch of neurons. Okay, something like this. So this is space horizontally, and then vertically we're plotting the firing frequency of these neurons. So in this case we've got about 100 of them. And you can see the firing frequency goes to zero at the edges, it's zero outside the bump, and it's positive on the inside of the bump. So this is what we mean by a bump. So instead of dealing with single neurons, as John did and Eugene, we're going to be talking about networks of neurons and pattern formation. So various uses of bumps. Several uses. One is for modeling short-term memory. So the best thing to do is not look at this slide while I tell you what this is supposed to represent. It's an experiment done on monkeys. Quite a simple one. You put them in front of a screen. You have a light that they're supposed to fixate on. And then while they're fixating on that light, another light flashes somewhere else in the visual space, flashes on and then off again. The monkey has to continue fixating on the light that it's looking at. And then after some time delay, 1 or 2 seconds, say, that light that it's looking at goes out, and it then has to move its eyes up to where that transient light flashed. Okay, and that's the end of the task. So it's basically a working memory task, because during the time between that flash of light and the monkey being able to move its eyes, it has to remember something. It has to remember the position in space of where that flash of light was. So that's what's called working memory. And you can do recordings of various neurons in the monkey's brain while it's doing this, and what you typically see in a lot of neurons is that they have a low firing frequency before the light flashes, and when the light flashes, the frequency goes up, and it stays up until the task is over, until the monkey moves his eyes, and then the firing rate goes down again. So that's interpreted as the neural correlate of working memory. Basically, that memory of what was going on and where it was is encoded in the spiking of that particular neuron. So this is a model for that sort of behavior. So on the right-hand side is the input current. On the left-hand side is a bunch of neurons. We have 100 neurons here, time running from top down to the bottom. So basically, this is before the task, before that light flashed on. So the monkey's just sitting there looking at the light it's supposed to look at. And then this input current here is spatially localized, and that represents that flash of light that went on and then off again. And it's spatially localized because, of course, that light is also spatially localized in space. And then the neurons start firing here. There's just a black spot every time the neuron fires, so this is a restogram. And the neurons continue firing, and then the light that it's looking at goes out after a couple of seconds, and it makes its saccade, the eyes move, and then the frequency goes down again, the task is over. So the neurons stop firing at this point in here. So this is just a representation of that sort of experiment. And the point of this is, if you take some time in here and you just look at the firing frequencies of these neurons, you'll see we have a bump. Okay, the firing frequency is zero outside the bump, and it's positive inside the bump. And in fact, by looking at this, you can see the frequency goes from zero at the edge up to some maximum in the middle, and then down to zero again in the middle. At the other edge, rather. So this is one example where it's thought that bumps are useful and used. So the important thing in this case is that the position of the bump actually encodes some feature of the memory. Again, because there's flashing light is somewhere in space, and there's a map from the visual space onto a visual cortex. Okay, so you expect to see these neurons doing this sort of thing in the part of the cortex which is mapped to the particular area in space where the light was. That's why they're spatially localized. So that's one particular example of where bumps might be used. There's various other ones that I won't go into. So we need to talk about adaptation as well. John just talked about this. Spike frequency adaptation, it's basically the idea that when you give a neuron a constant input, then its firing frequency gradually decreases over time. So this is what we're doing here. You probably can't see it from the top plot, but you can see, well, the spikes here are slightly faster than the spikes here. And this is the instantaneous frequency. You can see it drops from about 63 down to 53 or so over this amount of time. So this is spike frequency adaptation. And you can experience it for yourself. You go into a loud party or disco, you think, wow, that's really loud. And after about 10 minutes, it doesn't bother you anymore, okay, because you've adapted out that high volume. And then when you come outside, everything muffled, everything seems really quiet. And that's sort of the after effect of this adaptation. It's just a way of your body coping with a wide range of signals. If they're too high, you adapt them out. If it's too low, then you become sensitized to them. That's very common all over the nervous system. So basically what we're doing in this talk is we're going to add this property, which is generic, to a network capable of showing supporting those bumps there. See what happens. And, well, I've already told you here, the bump moves. Okay. So remembering that the position of the bump actually tells you something important. It tells you about what the memory is about. And that's obviously not good for this sort of working memory task. I'll just show you that. So here we have two plots. You look at the one on the left, first of all. So that's what happens if you take that previous model that I showed you there and add this spike frequency adaptation. The bumps start to move. In this case, we have periodic boundary conditions. So the bump moves off the side, comes back again, and round and round and round. This is a completely deterministic system. Again, 60 neurons in this case. So the bump will continue moving along at pretty much a constant speed for as long as you leave it. But what we found was if we add noise, this sort of thing on the right happens. Okay, so you can see, remembering this is periodic boundary conditions, in this case, over that amount of time, we've actually moved 1, 2, 3, 4 times the domain. And in the one on the right-hand side, we've moved around once, or one domain width. So basically, the effective speed of this bump has been decreased by a factor of 4, just by adding noise, yeah.
What determines the direction of
the bump? The direction is determined by the initial conditions. This is a symmetric domain, so there's no reason to go right or left. And what determines the speed is the strength of adaptation. Okay. So what happens, I'll show you later. Basically, there's a pitchfork bifurcation in velocity as the adaptation strength increases. And it's not at strength zero. It's some non-zero value. So you can put a small amount of spike frequency adaptation in, and you'll still get these stationary bumps. But if it's too big, these things start to move. And the point here, you might say, we're just adding noise to the system. It's going to destroy any sort of pattern you get. Okay, but it turns out, in this case, it doesn't. Restabilization. We call this restabilization because the velocity is decreased. And it occurs before destruction of the bump. You can see for this one, there's a bit more noise, but still at any given time, there's still a bump. Okay, so we haven't destroyed the bump. If you put too much noise in, then you will destroy the bump. This just turns into a mess because the dynamics are dominated by noise rather than the network effects. So we're just going to quantify the slowing down. Yeah. Because the position in all of the models that these bumps are used for, the position of the bump actually encodes something. Okay, so for example, that monkey test, the position of the bump encodes where that flash of light was. And the monkey's task is to move his eyes to where that light was. Okay, so he wants to know it was there, not over there. Because if he moves his eyes to the wrong position, he won't get his reward. Okay. And same sort of thing for all the other examples that I haven't mentioned where bumps are thought to be used. And again, the position of the bump tells you something. So just quantifying this slowing down, we plot the absolute value of the average speed. And to do that, we just run the simulation over a fixed amount of time, look at how far it's traveled. So take the position at the end minus the position at the beginning, take the absolute value, divide by the time, velocity, and plot this versus the noise intensity. That's what we've got here. So this noise is just randomly arriving current pulses, both excitatory and inhibitory, so they're balanced. No correlation or anything. It's just shot noise, basically over a network. And you can see the effect that we're talking about. For low noise, the bumps travel either to the right or the left. By taking the absolute value, we get rid of the direction. And you can see the velocity has dropped by a factor of about 4 as we increase this, the noise intensity. So this is the phenomenon that we're interested in. So that's the spiking model and spiking neuron model. And basically, there's not a lot you can do in networks with spiking neurons except simulate them. So we're interested in a bit more analysis. So what we did was move to a rate model. So in this case, basically the quantity of interest is not the voltage of any individual neuron, it's the rate of firing of that neuron. So we've got rid of the spiking. So this is the sort of model we're using. This is a rate model. So this is being well studied. It was introduced by Amari in the 70s, early 71. So basically U is the dependent variable. It's the quantity of interest, synaptic input, it doesn't really matter what it is. But basically it's a partial integral differential equation. So time derivative, negative of the quantity here to give you exponential decay. There's nothing else going on. And then this is convolution. Convolution of this kernel here, which is a Mexican hat. This tells you about the connectivity within the network. Basically, we have local excitation and further or distant inhibition. Again, very common in the nervous system. And then this function, capital F, which is actually related to what's called the FI curve or the firing rate of an individual neuron. It tells you its frequency of firing given its input. So without the A variable here, this is a standard Amari model. It's been studied a lot. And we need to include this spike frequency adaptation, so we do that by adding the second variable here. Basically, A is modeled as the adaptation is modeled as a subtractive current. Okay, subtractive current will decrease the firing rate. It happens on a slow time scale. And we have capital A here, which is the strength of the adaptation, which is the variable we're going to, parameter rather, that we're going to use to induce this bifurcation. So this is simpler. Pretty much told you what all this is. A just increases when U is high and decays exponentially otherwise with time constant tau, which is much greater than 1. So that does all the right thing without noise. But of course we're interested in noise, so we add spatiotemporal noise to the dynamics of A. So we just spatially discretize this into a bunch of ODEs and stick some white noise on the dynamics of A. So this model shows the same sort of behavior. So what that tells you is that spiking is not essential for this mechanism. We don't need spiking neurons. So in this case, we have low noise here. So this is our bump traveling off to the right in this case at a constant speed. And then we add more and more noise. So this is what happens for a moderate amount of noise in this sort of transition zone here. The bump moves around. Notice the different spatial scales on these three figures. Okay. Bump moves around a bit. Some of the time it's going at pretty much a constant velocity, but it switches direction occasionally. And then in this last one here, it's jiggling around all the time. And that's basically the mechanism that's going on. The noise perturbs the flow dynamics, which are responsible for moving the bump in the first place. So at the bottom, that's the same sort of plot, average speed as a function of noise intensity, so it shows the same sort of thing. Bumps move below noise intensity, there's this transition zone here, and then they slow down by a significant factor here. So a rate model does everything we want it to do. So this is what Eugene asked. Basically, what's the bifurcation that occurs as you increase the adaptation strength at the pitchfork? So for a particular form of J, remember that was the coupling function, you can show analytically that these actually arise through a supercritical pitchfork bifurcation in speed. That's what we plotted here. Parameter controlling amount of adaptation and the absolute value of the speed here. So there's our pitchfork. There's another branch down here. We've taken the absolute value to flip it up here. Okay, so we can say, well, that's the mechanism for this destabilization to make these things move. Let's just take the normal form of that. Okay, forget about space and everything. Let's take the normal form of this bifurcation and add noise to that and see if we can reproduce the same sorts of effects. So we did that. So this is first equation there. It's the normal form for supercritical hot bifurcation, where omega is now speed, and we've added some Gaussian white noise back here. And because we're really interested in position, we just add on this second equation, just integrating the velocity to get position. That's what it is. Okay, so this is the noisy normal form of the supercritical pitch hot bifurcation. And we do the same thing. Plot the absolute value of the average speed over an amount of time, in this case 1,000 time units, as a function of the noise intensity, and we see the same thing. It travels off at whatever the speed is, square root of lambda in this case, for low noise, and then we have the same sort of transition zone, and then down to a very slow speed with more noise. So this is even better, because instead of dealing with these spatially extended systems, we're now dealing with a normal form, which is an ODE. And to show you a typical realization of this process, this is in the transition zone, where we had that sharp decrease in velocity. So this is a typical realization of omega. So you can see it's negative, and positive, negative, positive. You get these switches. Just put that through a two-state filter to work out which side of zero it's on, which will be we need in a couple of minutes. And then integrating omega as a function of time gives you position. So this is what our bump was doing, traveling off in one direction, change again, and so on like that. So that was a stochastic ODE, which shows the right behavior. And what we're going to do is simplify it even further by passing this through that two-state filter and basically assuming that the velocity is constant in magnitude, either go to the left with one speed or to the right with the same speed. So the speed is now no longer a continuous variable, it's a discrete variable. That's going to make life even easier. So basically what that means is we're modeling it with a persistent random walk. And we'll start with discrete time first of all. Persistent random walk in one dimension. So basically we have a constant speed, that was the two-state filter, and then we need one more variable or parameter, probability of going in the same direction, or conversely of switching direction, which we're going to call P. So these are the sorts of trajectories you're going to get. So P equals 1, so it says we never change direction, we go off either to the left or to the right. P is 0.9, so on average, one out of every time steps we change direction. We get this sort of behavior here, four typical realizations. P is 0.3, we're switching all the time. And again, note the different spatial scales on these three figures. And what we're really interested in is the total distance traveled during a fixed amount of time. That's the thing we're always measuring for these various models. So I'll just show you typical distributions, probability distributions for this discrete time. Discrete space, persistent random walk. So this is P is 0.95, so that's the probability of going in the same direction at every time step. And these are the sorts of distributions you get for three different numbers of iterations, so 11, 23, and then 53. And this is for a smaller value of P, so they're more likely to switch direction. You can see various things in here. One is the distributions are zero outside the edges here. It just says the particle can't move faster than its velocity. Okay. And we have these peaks on here, on the edge, so they represent particles that never change direction. They're quite high in this one, and they're non-existent in this one. And then there's some non-zero sort of filling in the middle, and that represents particles that do change direction at least once. That was a discrete time persistent random walk. So then we can actually do a continuous time persistent random walk, which is just the limiting case of that, where the time step goes to zero. So that ends up with a stochastic ODE in this case. PXDT is I, where I is either minus V or plus V, depending on whether we're moving to the left or to the right. Okay, X is position. And we have our parameter, again, that tells us the probability of switching direction from minus V to V or V to minus V during a given amount of time dt is just given by this parameter beta. That's our switching rate, if you like. And the nice thing about this is the probability density function for X position satisfies the telegrapher's equation, this PDE, which has a solution in this case. So you can see the correspondence between the various terms here and the figure I just showed you. You have delta functions moving out at plus or minus B. So those are the peaks on the edges corresponding to things that never change direction. We have a heavy-sized function in here that chops off everything outside the ones that are moving out, so zero outside those. And then we have these two Bessel functions which just fill in the middle. So those are the three components of those distributions I just showed you. And now, since we know the probability density function, we can calculate everything analytically, in particular the mean absolute position at a given time. It's just this. So that's what I was plotting, or divided by t. And also the second moment, which enables us to get the standard deviation on those curves that I showed you. Again, it has a very simple expression. So we can work out the standard deviation. And there's one last connection we need to make. We had this parameter beta, which is a switching rate. We need to connect that back to our noise intensity. So we just use a standard sort of Arrhenius type rate for switching rate in terms of noise intensity d, where capital K and little c are both just parameters. And we fit those using data. And this is the sort of plot you get out of those analytical expressions. It's the same sort of thing. High speed for low noise intensity drops down, and the standard deviation, plus or minus one standard deviation, shows the right behavior. So just to summarize, basically we've shown that spatiotemporal noise, in this case, disrupts the mechanism responsible for this bifurcation, the stationary bumps to moving bumps bifurcation, and effectively restabilizes the pattern. Okay. And that was our observation from this big spiking neural network, and what I did was progressively simplify the models to get down to that last one. So on the way, we looked at a noisy pitchfork bifurcation, and the last one was just using a persistent random walk to get that last figure. And the overall message in this case is that moderate amounts of noise in this case can be good. Okay, good in the sense of keeping the position of the bump, which encodes some information, in roughly the same space instead of letting it run off. Okay. Some questions, which we still don't know the answers to. What are the essential ingredients for this? One interesting thing we had here was this convolutional coupling, or integral coupling, spatially extended coupling. Okay, it's not diffusion, it's not local coupling. And we have a counterexample. It's not hard to get one. Just use Fitzsimmons-Guimel or something and diffusively couple them, and this behavior doesn't happen. You get moving bands of activity. You add noise, they just break up. They don't slow down at all. Okay, so that's, is this essential? I don't know. Slow variable. We do have this sort of separation of timescales between the fast U dynamics and the slow adaptation dynamics. Is that necessary or not? Do we need that pitchfork bifurcation? If we had things that started moving for some other reason, would we see the same sort of behavior? Which other systems will this work? There's a number of other systems that show this this sort of behavior, isolated patches of whatever activity that move in a pitchfork bifurcation. There's three species reaction diffusion equation, two species reaction diffusion with global coupling, coupled against the Landau equations, all show this sort of behavior. So will this same sort of behavior occur in those models? We don't know. And then the last thing, are there any ideas on numerical algorithms for solving these sorts of equations? We've done them sort of using the simplest way possible, using doing a convolution with just a Riemann integral and integrating in time with an Euler step. Okay. I know there are better ways, but are there any significantly better ways of integrating these sorts of partial integral differential equations? And that's it. Thanks.